Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 16th of July. Deepest thanks to John Munson for filling in for me for the last week while I tended to my father. And if I appear to have a lapse in knowledge of what's happened last week, that is the reason. So just fill me in on the news. I have a little understanding of what's been happening, but not a lot. But I know that you do. It's our All Things Political segment this hour. We'll be looking at all that's been making news, the White House holding firm on its Iraq strategy, the president saying that he needs to hear from the commanders on the ground who make an assessment of where we are, the Democrats favoring tougher steps to restrict the president's options, and now some moderate Republicans who are calling for a process for reviewing Iraq plans. We'll be looking at news today that John McCain has no money. His presidential campaign spent more than it raised from April through June, leaving him financially strapped with only 3.2 only, I say, is an indication of how things are going. Only $3.2 million cash on hand, and he has a $1.8 million debt. Barack Obama, Hillary Rodham Clinton ended the first half of the year with more than $30 million each for the presidential primaries. And we'll be talking about money and politics. Lady Bird Johnson died. We will talk about her because our guest is joining us from Texas today. We'll look at North Korea. We'll look at what Michael Chertoff said about whether or not America is vulnerable to a terrorist attack. And what about this new assessment that al-Qaeda has regrouped and is stronger than any time since 2001? Just a few of the issues on the table. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. Should you be joining us in Milwaukee today, our Milwaukee line is 414-227-2050. And Professor Matthew Eshbaugh-Soha is our guest, assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of North Texas, author of The President's Speeches Going Beyond Public. His research focuses on American political institutions, including the presidency, Congress, bureaucracy, and news media. Professor Eshbaugh-Soha, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for having me.
Well, the news that's dominating news from National Public Radio is yet more bombings and more death in Iraq today. Mm-hmm. Let's look at this strategy here, because I think that we're calling out in a huge way for some kind of change. The American people are. Mm-hmm. The White House saying they need to hear from commanders on the ground, holding firm. Republicans starting to break away from that. Democrats saying they need tougher steps to restrict what the options are. What are the options? Who has a plan you think that the American people would support?
Well, that's a good question. It seems to me that, I mean, the American people want change, but it's often difficult to look to the American people, particularly on complex issues like a war in Iraq, for specific solutions. So I think that clearly change is there. We've seen some modest change in terms of Rumsfeld being replaced after the midterm elections. But in terms of clear support for, you know, immediate withdrawal, we don't see that, right? Mm-hmm. That tends to be the position of Democrats in Congress. But I think the American people are also wary of a withdrawal that happens too quickly, in that it might create a power vacuum and cause other problems. So I don't think we can really look to the American people for clear guidance on this. That's why members of Congress are proposing different plans. I think the study group, different hints about diplomacy and maybe drawing down some troops. I think if I were to look at polling of those specific questions, I think you would see some support for that as some ideas for what to do.
Yeah. What about the comment, I think it was from the Prime Minister of Iraq, saying, you know, the Iraqi forces can handle this now. It's time for you to go home.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of comments about that you know, maybe he was speaking more to the Iraqi people. Clearly, if the American people buy that, I think they would be overjoyed. Great, let's go home.
Mm-hmm.
Some research by my colleagues here show, however, that if at the University of North Texas, if American troops leave, the government will fall. And so in that sense, the Bush administration is right. But I think that, you know, is that an accurate statement? Is that something that, in fact, you know, would take place? And I think that's an open question. Perhaps this is something that the generals, the military officials, will talk about when they appear before Congress in September.
I've said this many times on this show, but it is amazing to me that day after day after day after day, the news headlines are 70 people are killed, mm-hmm. hundreds are wounded. It goes on and on and on. Are we somewhat numb to this now, or are we upset by it?
Well, there might be a little bit of both. But, yeah, I agree. I mean, it's, you know, you look at the news, and I know I've commented to myself on many times, you know, oh, you know, another bomb went on in Iraq. Mm-hmm. in Iraq. You know, it is a daily occurrence, and it's something that I think does numb the American people. But at the same time, you know, it has led to a decline in support for the war in Iraq. And the more that happens, I think the more people will begin to question whether this is worth additional American lives.
And then everybody goes on vacation in August, right? The American lawmakers, the Iraqis.
I had heard that as well. And I, you know, I haven't heard a lot. I mean, it's difficult for American policymakers to compromise and come up with policy solutions. You can just imagine how difficult it is for Iraqi politicians to come together and compromise. And that's what it requires, is compromise. Certainly going on vacation doesn't help, but even when they've been in session, the reports that I've read and heard is they haven't been making that much progress anyway.
Right. What do you make of this new assessment that al-Qaeda has now regrouped? It is functioning from the same place where it has in northern Pakistan, and it is stronger mm-hmm. than any time since 2001.
Well, it's troubling. I can't comment specifically on, you know, whether the report is correct. I think that it raises the larger question that, you know, of an issue that didn't really stick in the 2004 campaign. It was raised, but people didn't really embrace it, that, you know, perhaps Iraq was a distraction, that, you know, that, you know, we had al-Qaeda and the Taliban on the run in Afghanistan, and maybe resources should have been spent there, but instead we kind of started to engage in a two-front war, which history tells us never seems to work, except in World War II. I guess there's always an exception. Yeah, I think it's very troubling. Naturally, the president came out and puts a positive spin on those numbers and claims that that is not an accurate perception of al-Qaeda's strength. But, you know, he has one thing going for him on that, is that fortunately there haven't been any domestic attacks since 9/11. But that in itself isn't a clear piece of evidence that, in fact, al-Qaeda is weaker, that al-Qaeda is incapable of striking. It just means that they haven't.
What about Michael Chertoff's comments, having a gut feeling that America might be vulnerable to a terrorist attack this summer? Did he speak out of turn?
That's really an interesting question. You know, we certainly would expect that the Secretary of Homeland Security would have information, would be able to, and perhaps should be able to make some statements on this. You know, and that was the sort of the first comment that sort of got the ball rolling, so to speak, on this issue, getting comments from the press secretary, Tony Snow, and also the president himself on Friday. That's troubling mm-hmm. when the Secretary of Homeland Security says that. You know, did he speak out of turn? I know that the Bush administration doesn't like it when political appointees say things that seem to run counter to the White House's official line, but I think is... You know, if that is his feeling, I think that at least the American people deserve to hear that other perspective. The real question is, okay, what is being done to try and address that gut feeling?
What's the answer to that?
I don't know.
We don't know, do we?
I don't think we do. I mean, there's questions raised in on the news and in various news media programs that I've watched, you know, are we going to raise the terror alert level? Well, you know, what does that really do? I mean, it seems like, you know, after the bombing in Scotland, you know, there was a little bit more security at airports, a little bit of show of force there. But I think that hopefully that policymakers and planners and intelligence gatherers are doing what they need to do to try and sort of act on that gut feeling and gather enough evidence to thwart an attack if one is pending, either in the short term or long term.
And do you think that information, whatever they're doing, needs to be made public somehow?
Well, anything with foreign policy and national security gets a little bit tricky, because yes, the American people, I think, have a right to know. This is a democracy, and it could help. I mean, a lot of what I think we hear is that, you know, for people to be vigilant, and if people can be vigilant about, if they know what to be vigilant about, that might be more helpful, and that might be a better way to not only inform the American people, but if it's something that's out in the news, you know, maybe those, you know, border guards or other people in airport security who undoubtedly are going to get a memo, but memos can get lost in a very thick federal bureaucracy, perhaps that would help get the word out as well in terms of what to look for. But on the other hand, concerning national security intelligence issues, you don't want to give up too much information where you might tip off, you know, the people who you're about to catch before they commit an attack.
Right.
So, you know, I'm sure there's a balance there. I don't know precisely what that is, but I think there has to be an amount of information that can be conveyed to the American people.
Let's move to another area. Senator John McCain has no money. What's happened?
Well, he's on the wrong side of the two most popular, unpopular issues of 2007, the Iraq War and immigration reform. I mean, that's it. I think he, you know, was seen early on as the front runner, and he was making overtures to key conservatives, and people remembered his 2000 campaign. And they thought fondly about that, and yeah, I think he did some good things early on. But, you know, the bottom line is people are seeing his positions on Iraq and immigration reform, and they don't like it in the Republican Party, and they're not giving him money.
Right. So how long can he hang on, do you think?
Well, things can change. I mean, there could be, you know, there could be something that could afflict the one of the front runners. I mean, Giuliani has had, you know, a swift boat like attack against him. Maybe that would damage him sufficiently. You know, maybe there would be enough questions about Mitt Romney for conservatives and others that would give John McCain an opportunity. But I think that, I mean, he's had a bad quarter in terms of fundraising, and, you know, again, he's taking positions on Iraq that are unpopular with a lot of Americans, even though, you know, there's a conservative base that supports the president on this. You throw in immigration reform, which John McCain also mm-hmm. supported, and he's going to alienate, you know, all but a handful of supporters. So potentially, if he's able to hang on immigration reform, he might be able to distance himself from that. It's probably not going to come up again in terms of a vote. He'll probably have to explain that position down the road. But, you know, perhaps the political landscape could change sufficiently for him to get back in the race. You know, John Kerry in 2003, you know, was trailing fairly significantly in the polls, but it's hard to predict. I mean, it doesn't look good for John McCain. Certainly.
No. What a change of fortune, right?
Absolutely. And that's why it's so hard to, you know, we look at who the front runners are now. In 2003, you know, Howard Dean was the Democratic front runner at this time, or at least by the fall, and it's hard to predict because people are not paying attention. There are a lot of, in the polling, there's a lot of high, never heard of numbers for Romney and some of these other candidates. And, you know, people don't vote until January, and it's the primaries in the caucuses that count. So,
how many months away is that now? This thing goes on and on and on and on.
Yeah, it's 6 months away.
Oh,
I mean,
gosh.
Really, and it's even earlier than you know, 2004. I mean, we at least used to be able to get through the Super Bowl before we, you know, decided on the candidates, and now it's, you know, mid-January.
Right.
And, you know, we knew in 2004 Kerry was going to be the nominee probably in mid, early March. This year it might be, you know, before Valentine's Day. And that's extraordinarily early.
We're going to welcome phone calls. We have a number of other areas. Our guest is in Texas, too, and I want to talk about Lady Bird Johnson sometime during the rest of this hour. And please feel free to join us in talking about all things political, be it the presidential campaign, be it what in the world do we want in terms of an Iraq strategy. What does it mean for two fairly prominent Republican moderate senators, John Warner and Richard Lugar, saying that they want to give the president until mid-October to submit a plan to restrict the use of U.S. troops in Iraq? What about Homeland Security Director Michael Chertoff saying that he was worried that America might be vulnerable to a terrorist attack? How about the assessment that al-Qaeda has regrouped and it's stronger than any time since 2001? Shouldn't we be doing something about that? Here's our line for you to join us, 800-486-8255. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you're in Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050. Professor Matthew Eshbaugh Soha, assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of North Texas, author of The President's Speeches Going Beyond Public, is our guest for All Things Political, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All Things Political, which is what we always do on Mondays at 9 o'clock, and we're welcoming your phone calls at 800-486-8655, starting with Diane from Milwaukee. Hi, Diane.
Hi. If the Iraqi government can go on vacation and George Bush can go on vacation, then our troops should go on vacation for the same amount of time. They can just sit in the green zone and play basketball.
Professor Esposito, what do you think of that? Let's all go on vacation.
Yeah, well, I mean, I see the point. I mean, it sounds fair to me. It's the troops that are really, you know, sacrificing. I mean, they're dying, they're being wounded, and I see the point. I think that's a very clever statement.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Diane, for your call. Jason from Appleton is next. Hi, Jason.
Hello.
Hi.
Just a couple of quick comments. I saw, I think it was last night on MSNBC, a new report, I forget who did it, talking about, they estimate about 45% of the people, the insurgents that are coming into Iraq are coming through Saudi Arabia. And I remember hearing that like a year ago, yet they were kind of saying they're anticipating what the administration is going to say about that because they lead you to believe that they're mostly coming from Syria and Iran. So I'm wondering a comment on that. And the other comment, I've thought for years, every once in a while you hear people refer to these insurgents as terrorists. Well, a lot of these people, of course, we all know they're not al-Qaeda. They're, you know, Sunni and Shiites who don't want us there. Does that make them terrorists because they don't agree with us being there? And I'm wondering what everyone's comment is on that. And I'll take the comments off the air.
Thanks, Jason.
Well, I'd say about Saudi Arabia, I had seen that in snippets as well. I think that's an interesting report as well. It seems to suggest to me that, you know, as we've heard for years, and the Iraq Study Group has pointed to this, that there's not going to be a military solution. And in fact, diplomacy is very important. And if, in fact, a good number of these individuals are coming from Saudi Arabia, it seems to encourage further diplomacy with Saudi Arabia and the others. The administration's line has been, well, you know, we're reluctant to be diplomatic with Iran and Syria, but Saudi Arabia is a close ally, so maybe that study is a way to encourage additional diplomacy. I think that's got to be part of this component. In terms of insurgents being terrorists, I appreciate the caller's point. I think you can look at this in any number of ways, but clearly the administration is going to have more support, and the support is fairly low right now, for continued military intervention in Iraq if they can convince people that they're fighting terrorists, because nobody likes terrorists. And I think once you start, I think the caller is right that it's much more complicated than that. But if people can compartmentalize these individuals fighting American troops as terrorists, we all want to, nobody likes terrorism, so why shouldn't we support that sort of action? So I think in some ways it's semantics and an effort on the part of the administration to frame this in the best way that they can for their position.
It's so hard, isn't it, Professor Esbaugh, so hard to imagine some kind of peaceful resolution to all of this. It's so hard to imagine even 10 or 20 years from now.
Oh, yeah.
Isn't it?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, democracies don't solve themselves. They don't solve all their problems overnight. I mean, the United States knows this all too well. Major issues involving slavery aren't resolved until the Civil War, and then the underlying issues with that take, you know, much longer to be resolved. So I think any expectation at the beginning of this that this was going to be an easy campaign, I think if the administration made that point, they were, they were misleading. But, I think it's, I think it's a matter of sort of having an acceptable level of violence. It's not going to be peaceful anytime soon. It's a matter of what level of violence is acceptable to ultimately policymakers in Washington, D.C., and also in Iraq.
When will the mission be accomplished? I don't know.
Yeah. we hear a lot of this, the Powell Doctrine about what the mission is and you know, what we're trying to accomplish. The Bush administration effectively rejected the Powell Doctrine by not establishing a clear objective, and I think that's part of the problem. That's part of the reason why, you know, we have increasingly, okay, let's wait until this point. Let's wait until this election. Let's wait until, this particular event happens. Now it's let's wait until September. And when you don't go in with a clearly defined objective, then, in effect, there is no end in sight. And that end has to be decided down the road. In effect, what, even though the administration is saying that they want to rely on the generals and the soldiers on the ground, in effect, the end is going to be decided by someone other than that, in part because the administration didn't establish what that end goal was going to be in the first place.
We go next to Jean. Hi, Jean.
Hi.
Hi.
I got two comments.
All right.
The first is about Chertoff's announcement about his gut feeling.
Right.
Owing to terrorism. I think my feeling on this is that it's totally politically motivated. I don't think there's any secret information that we don't know about. Giuliani is running almost entirely on fear of terrorism and look what I did in New York and I'll be strong against terrorists. The second point is, so if we don't get attacked this summer, the administration can say, oh, look, we kept you safe. So I think it's political. It's a win-win situation for him to say that, whether there's any proof of it or not. Second point I'd like to make about the increasing strength of al-Qaeda. Well, of course, al-Qaeda is strengthening. And the main reason they're strengthening is our war in Iraq. Osama bin Laden has always claimed that the Western powers want to invade and occupy Muslim lands. And he said this at a time when we weren't totally into that. Bush played right into his hands. He said it would happen. It is. So, what do you expect? And the longer the war goes on, the faster al-Qaeda is going to grow. And those are my comments.
Thanks very much, Gene, for them. Professor?
Yeah, I've heard these before, and I think that there's certainly some grounding to it. A lot of, you know, terrorism studies demonstrate that if the United States is involved in military action, that's going to be an excellent recruitment tool for al-Qaeda and other terrorist organizations. So I think caller's certainly on solid ground there. In terms of whether Chertoff's comment, you know, was politically motivated, you know, it could be. Ultimately, I would say that everything that a politician or a policymaker does in some respects has some political motive behind it. I don't know what the clear motive would be politically for that, if, you know, voters would associate being safer with Giuliani or some other candidate, or what the administration would have to gain from it, other than, you know, if in fact, regardless of whether it's political or not, if next summer or throughout the rest of the Bush administration, if in fact there are no terrorist attacks, the president can, you know, maintain that we're safer. But it's up to the American people to decide whether they feel safer, whether it's because of the president's policies. And indeed, if there is some, you know, political motivation to skew gut feelings in one way or another to benefit a particular point of view, that they'll make a decision on whether that's acceptable and hopefully make you know, an appropriate and informed decision in 2008 when they go vote.
Well, what about that? He said these comments when last week or the week before, I've been out of touch, but has there been, has that resulted in an increase in support for Republican candidates now? Do we still see them as much stronger when it comes to fighting terrorism?
Yeah, I think it's too early. I mean, that was last week, so any kind of polling that might get at that, I think any bump would be marginal. I think certainly in the past, Republicans have been seen as the preferred party on fighting the war on terrorism. Traditionally, they've been seen as the preferred party fighting on defense-related issues. So we'll see. Potentially, if it's able to be framed in a way that Republicans are stronger on protecting Americans, and that is the top issue. Mm-hmm. And it may not be. It might be Iraq, which is increasingly a separate issue. I think fewer and fewer Americans are willing to sort of tie them together, saying, we're safer because we're in Iraq. I think increasingly people are saying just the opposite. But I would also say right now, any kind of statement like that, it's unlikely to have any significant impact on vote choices, 15 months from now.
Right. Bill is next. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Quick comment about John McCain. I realize you discussed him briefly, but he had to make a pivotal decision in South Carolina in 2000 after the attacks on him and questioning his patriotism, et cetera. And had he decided to stand up and say, hey, wait a minute, I will not accept this. If it costs me my chance to be the president, so be it. Somebody has to stand up and say, this is not acceptable. We cannot run elections like this. He may have been able to stop George Bush right there at that time, but he didn't do it, and essentially sold his soul for a chance in 2008, and it didn't work. And it didn't work for our country. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Professor.
Yeah, I mean, that South Carolina primary was pretty nasty and pretty dirty. Yeah, whether McCain could have, even if he stood up, it would have had to have led to a significant amount of donations in his direction because he was running out of money. After that, he did well in Michigan and some other states, but, he just didn't have the money. At the time, George W. Bush had raised the most money in the history of, the primary season, and it certainly seemed as if he would have won regardless, but that's one thing that, we'll never know for sure. Certainly, there were a few steps along the way that could have prevented George W. Bush from being president, and perhaps history would be different.
Our guest for All Things Political this Monday is Professor Matthew Eshbaugh Soha, assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of North Texas, and we have one line open. The lines get crowded for this discussion, so if you'd like to join us, the number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. In Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Matt from Lake Geneva, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'm finding the fundraising for the presidential camp race is very interesting. It looks like the Democratic candidates are raising money at a rate of almost 5-1 compared to the top Republican candidates. I don't know if this is because the Democratic base is more and the big donors are more motivated, or what the reason is. But the Republican fundraising is actually pretty poor. When you look at the leaders like Mitt Romney and Rudy Giuliani, they've largely put in their own money into the campaigns. Mitt Romney put in $7 million of his own in the second quarter and only raised $2 million, which is actually pretty interesting when you think that Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama are raising, over
$30
million in a quarter, right. Yeah. And one bright spot that I saw in the whole thing was that Ron Paul, a candidate from Texas, a congressman from Texas, that he greatly surpassed all the expectations of the pundits in raising about $2.5 million in the second quarter. I remember that Ken Rudin, when he was on your show, had pretty low expectations for Paul's ability to raise money. And actually, it turns out that Paul raised more money from individual contributors than anybody else in the Republican Party. And it's interesting that nobody's talking about that. I think that tells a lot about what's going on,
Professor.
Yeah, I think that that's a a very astute observation. I hadn't really noticed that or thought about it. But there are any number of ways to think about that. One could be in the past, Republicans, maybe what's happening is Republicans are spreading their money around. Maybe they're unsure about who they want. In the past, we would see Republicans rallying around one individual, and they would have a clear shot to the nomination. So maybe that's an indication of you know, some splintering in the Republican Party. Maybe Democrats are more unified. Maybe Democrats are more excited about their candidates, Clinton and Obama, and so therefore are giving more money. Maybe people who might be more independent, more moderate, are thinking that the Democrats are going to win the White House and they want to be behind the right party for that election.
Exactly.
So I think there are any number of issues, but I think the observations are interesting. And yeah, I don't think we get a lot of sort of that nuanced analysis in most of the news reports, but I think that we'll have to wait and see what our inferences are and what they if they turn out to be true. But I think that there's a lot to be said about what the caller just mentioned.
Isn't this money thing though amazing? There's so much money involved.
Oh, yeah.
Here, and here they are going to this fundraiser and that fundraiser.
Yeah.
Let's change it. This is crazy to spend this kind of money, and for our candidates who ought to be just totally, it seemed to me, addressing the many issues that face us. Instead, let's meet with this hedge fund guy or gal,
yeah,
and this person, and go to this fundraiser and this Hollywood thing. It's kind of out of whack.
Yeah, well, you think about, how that money could be spent for other things.
Right.
Certainly a lot of money out there. I think it was Bob Schieffer towards the end of the 2004 primary season in 2004 on CBS. He was talking about wanting to sort of reform the system. And remember, we got away from the conventions because party leaders had too much power. But effectively what's happening now is that the donors have a lot of power and influence, and the media have enormous amount of power and influence over who's likely to be the front runner. And, his suggestion was, well, maybe we just need to put clear timetables on this. Maybe we do need to have some sort of convention-like nomination, because the longer it gets, and we're getting the nomination season is becoming longer and longer, the more money candidates have to raise. You know, it used to be that maybe it was the fall of the year before, or maybe, Robert Kennedy, he declared his candidacy to run for the nomination in March of 1968. And the longer it gets, and it's, getting longer every cycle, the more money that's going to have to be raised. So there's little that can be done in terms of campaign finance, in terms of limiting spending. The Supreme Court has been clear that that would be a violation of freedom of speech, but perhaps there's a way that Congress can reform the system by putting clear timetables on this.
Matt from Lake Geneva, hi. Oh, no, I got, we already did, Matt. Sorry, David is next. Hi, David.
Hi, good morning. I'd like to make two comments. I think we need to be more realistic about the forces involved in why we were willing to invade another sovereign country. And that is, there is a war machine in this country that has enormous power. You were talking about if you're able to call somebody a terrorist, well, everybody dislikes or hates terrorists. So that legitimizes trying to kill them, supposedly. And that's what happened here again. There was a whole propaganda machine put into play to demonize Saddam Hussein. And there are corporate powers that insisted that we invade Iraq for the purpose of making money. So why do we keep trying to figure out what good purpose there is? There was no good purpose. It was not to defend against for the United States against this poor, impoverished country. It was not to spread democracy. It was about making money. And if you take a look at it, they're still making money. Let's start looking at it that way.
What do you think it was about, Professor Eshbaz Soha?
Oh, geez, that's, it really depends on who you talk to with that, right? I mean, we have seen the sort of the transition in the reasoning, without question. So, you know, going into it, I'm stumped.
We don't know.
I don't. Yeah, I mean, there are any number of reasons, but they changed so many times. I think the motivation, as some accounts suggest, was, you know, to get rid of Saddam Hussein. There were some people in the Bush administration who could not fathom that September 11th could have been conducted without a state sponsor. So they were looking for that link. There was sort of this their worldview was such that September 11th could only happen with a nation sponsoring that, and the most likely nation to sponsor that is Iraq. So therefore, we should go after Iraq. In terms of money, I mean, there's no question that the amount of money spent in the military, you know, vendors, so to speak, are making money off of this. And I think that, you know, we've seen that in Vietnam. But I think that, you know, it might be short-term gain, but perhaps long-term cost. Remember that Eisenhower, upon leaving office, you know, warned of an industrial military complex that was too extensive. And I think an economy that's tied too much to military intervention probably will not do well in the long run.
Thanks very much for the call. Let's go to John next from Eagle River. Hi, John.
Hi, morning. How are you?
Okay. How are
good.
You?
Good. Matt, a question for you. It seems to me that liberals and progressives from almost the very beginning, all our predictions and suspicions about this administration have been right on, from predicting that Bush would pardon Libby and predicting that we were really behind torture and predicting that the war would be a disaster and the mission was not accomplished as early on as Bush said it was. At any rate, he says that you know, history will judge him, and history, I think, near-term and long-term will judge him as the worst, dumbest president we've ever had. My question really is, I don't know how long you've been in Texas, but was his administration in Texas run with such secrecy, misguidance, mismanagement, and in the end, prevarication and lies as this administration of the national government has been?
Well, I got to Texas in 98, so right when Bush was running for re-election. So I can't comment in terms of my general perception. You know, one thing to keep in mind is that the governor of Texas is fairly weak, certainly has much less power than the president of the United States, not only relatively speaking, but also in absolute terms. It's very decentralized. So the likelihood that, you know, we'd see any kind of executive action like what we're seeing in the White House, it may not be a good comparison. I know there have been documentaries. You know, Karl Rove has been with Bush for a while, and certainly there are some similarities in the style of campaigning about, you know, using social or other wedge issues to kind of attack the opponent. But, you know, I don't know. That's a good question for somebody to look into, see if there's a style of management that would have led to a concerted effort to deceive. One could maintain that, you know, maybe Bush wasn't that prepared, that maybe the governor of Texas is not the best position to be in to really make tough and difficult decisions, and his sort of business style of management of being more of a cheerleader and a delegator as opposed to somebody who really grapples with the facts and really wants to ask questions and gather as much information that he can so he can make the best decision. You know, maybe he wasn't trained as well as perhaps we would have liked to make the really tough decisions that he's been faced with.
I don't think anything could have prepared him.
Well, what about his father? His father was president, for heaven's sake.
Well, that's true. I mean, you know, he doesn't talk to his father from what I understand. The Bush administration is very good at politics, but they haven't been that good at making policy. And, you know, in some ways you're right. I mean, you can't be prepared to be president until you're actually president of the United States. But there are some presidents who I would look back on and say, gosh, they probably would have made better decisions. The decision may have been the same, and in some ways that's irrelevant. In some ways it's the process of going through as much information as you can. And, you know, if you do that and you entertain a variety of points of view and you haven't made up your mind ahead of time, you're more likely to make a better, more informed decision that presumably would lead to better policy outcomes.
Thanks, John.
Thank you.
More phone calls in a moment. All things political this hour. And our guest is an assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of North Texas. Professor Matthew Eshbaugh Soha is with us, author of The President's Speeches Going Beyond Public. His research focuses on American political institutions, the presidency, Congress, bureaucracy, and news media. One line is open if you want to talk, take that line. 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program this Monday, a study released last week on the social stigma that young people who are obese face. It's pervasive, and our guests say that it can have serious consequences for emotional and physical health. So that's coming up the second hour of our program. We continue with all things political, and Professor Matthew Eshbaugh Soha, 800-486-8655, 227-2050 in Milwaukee. Speaking to us from Texas, I'd like for you to comment on Lady Bird Johnson for a moment, who at one point said, I feel like I'm on stage for a part I never rehearsed, her husband assuming the presidency after the Kennedy assassination.
Yeah.
We all kind of liked her, didn't we? I mean, we liked her.
Yeah, I think, you know, I'm thinking back in terms of my own, you know, research on the presidency. Obviously, I wasn't alive during the Johnson administration. But, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, a lot of the conservation efforts that Johnson put forth were certainly part of, you know, Lady Bird Johnson. There's, you know, her mark is on that. The Highway Beautification Act, is an example. You know, I lived in College Station, Texas, for a while, and you know, there was sort of a yearly effort to encourage people to throw wildflower seeds on the side of the road. And I think that was an idea that was, one of Lady Bird Johnson. So I think, we'll see what more and more people have to say about her, but I think the ultimate conclusion is you know, there's a first lady who held herself with dignity at a very, very difficult time in American history.
Right. And who was married to a guy who was probably fairly difficult. I mean, he was just so exuberant in so many ways, plant kisses on her in the middle of a meeting
but
a guy who was larger than life, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Lyndon Johnson is sort of the prototypical Texan, you know. And he was that Texas politician who, had a very strong personality.
Mm-hmm. We go next to Jay from Chicago. Hi, Jay.
Thank you for taking my call, Kathleen. Giuliani has made the centerpiece of his campaign his response after 9/11. The New York City Fire Department has just released a video placing the blame for the loss of the firefighters' lives on Giuliani's decision to have a no-bid contract on the radios that the firefighters used. They were out of communication when the towers collapsed. I'd like the professor's opinion on what kind of an impact that's going to have on the Giuliani campaign. I'll take my response off the air.
Thanks, Jay.
Yeah, that's an extraordinary development. I mean, it is, people have been calling it, you know, a swift boat attack on Giuliani, and I think it's very similar to the attack on John Kerry. You know, we'll see how Giuliani responds. If he's able to get out of this and get beyond this and address it effectively, it might be a non-issue. In terms of its timing, you know, if he's able to get the nomination, he might be able to bury it. Of course, with Kerry, you know, those major attacks occurred right after the Democratic National Convention, and it appears that they muted some of the bump he would have gotten out of that convention. And it was certainly an issue that he had to respond to because he was campaigning in part on his military service, preparing him to be commander-in-chief. So I think the similarities are striking, and we'll see if Giuliani has learned anything, and in some ways, it remains to be seen whether it will damage his campaign, but it is an intriguing development.
Do you think he's the Republicans' guy?
You know, I've been telling people in my students that it's not going to be Giuliani, and that's just my sense. I remember a campaign ad. I think it was Ron Kirk running against John Cornyn here for the Senate race in 2002, and one of the ads that really struck me was Ron Kirk with Hillary Clinton, not Ron Kirk with Hillary Clinton, but Ron Kirk with Hillary Clinton wearing a Yankees hat. And I think that, you know, in Texas, in the South, you know, that old Pace Picante sauce commercial, you know, New York City, I think that in itself just strikes me as something that he's going to have to, you know, address. And I don't know if he's conservative enough on the social issues to be able to sort of overcome that that sort of perspective.
We go to Dan from Madison next. Hi, Dan.
Hi.
Hi.
I guess my question, I want to go back to kind of the race for candidates for president. And, like, all I've been hearing in the news with the money is just kind of the horse race that Barack outraised Hillary, and the Dems are beating the Republicans, and it almost seems to end at that point. And I'm just wondering, like, how much is the media kind of complicit in kind of just propping up, you know, images and, like, little sound bites rather than, like, investigating more detail? What are the issues, and where the money is coming from? Which is, I think money is very important, but following the money, I think, is probably the real story.
Yeah, well, I think that's a good way to characterize news coverage of campaigns. It is the horse race. It's very superficial. It lacks policy substance. Most of what people are going to come away with, unless they do a substantial amount of research on their own, they can go to the websites and find who's giving money without question. Most people aren't going to do that. So most people are going to come away thinking, oh, Obama has raised more money than Clinton, or Romney has the most money. They don't know policy positions yet. And I would say, well, it's because it's early in the campaign, but we know when January and February roll around, this is what the news media focus on. They focus on the horse race, who's winning and who's losing. Poll results, not substantive policy. And that's, you know, if media are driving a lot of the coverage and in informing us about who we should support for our party's nominees, you know, it's a real question. Maybe they should be a little bit more substantive.
So how do we change that? Because it seems like every election cycle I hear it, it's about the horse race, and that's a common critique. But then every year it's the same thing.
Yeah, it's increasingly that. I don't know how to change it. I think that, you know, it could be people demanding it, and, you know, people are sort of the consumers of that product of television news, and people keep watching it, and people support the types of programs that focus on, you know, who's leading the money race and who's leading in the polls, as opposed to substantive policy discussions. There are, you know, news programs on PBS. People can watch C-SPAN, you know, to gather more information. They can watch entire speeches, stump speeches from these candidates. But the American people don't want that. They want just enough information to make a relatively informed decision. And as rational actors, I can understand that. But I think the point is well taken that the news media do not provide substantive coverage. Will it change? Some people would say, well, it depends on the American people. Clearly, if you turn to newspapers, people can get a lot of information as well on the Internet. People have that opportunity to become better informed. But absolutely, increasingly, the focus is on the horse race, on who's winning the money race, and not on substantive policy decisions.
Is there, though, some kind of presidential primary in place right now when it comes to the money? In other words, is there a correlation between the money raised to date and the people's preference?
Yeah, I think so, because you raise more money, you're going to have more media attention, and this is going to influence people's perceptions of the candidate. If that's what they are, you know, I mean, the media may not be able to determine the winner, but they can certainly help the voters, the potential voters, eliminate individuals who are trailing in money. And that's the primary cue that people are going to look at. You need to have, everybody knows you need money to win. We don't know exactly how much money you win, but that's a good indicator, right? If, especially, you know, in the general election, you decide on party, Democrat or Republican. In the primaries, everybody's a Democrat or everybody's a Republican, so you need to rely on something else.
Right.
Maybe the amount of media attention, the amount of money is one way to do that. They feed on each other,
right,
which influences who ends up winning in January and February.
Thanks so much for the call. Let's go to Pat next from Eau Claire. Hi, Pat.
Hi. I just want to talk about the Bill Moyers Journal this weekend, and he was interviewing John Nichols, and the entire program was on impeachment. And I think the impeachment drum is getting louder and louder, and it's not going to be able to be ignored for much longer.
Do you think so? I'm missing that somehow. I don't hear that. Where are you hearing that from, Pat?
Well, from many of my friends.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm hearing that from the John Nichols of the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's not radical. He's got a level head on his shoulders. He's not.
Oh, he's a smart guy. Yeah, no doubt about that. Very smart guy. What do you?
I believe Bush and Cheney need to be impeached to regain our status in the world.
I understand. Do you think that there's a growing movement in that regard, Professor?
I don't see that much. I think there's a small minority. They could become increasingly more vocal about calling for impeachment. We've heard that. You know, we heard about at the 2006 midterm elections, if Democrats took control, would they impeach? I think it really comes down to a question of Democrats want to take the presidency and they want to maintain control of Congress. So there's a long-term gain for them if they can win in 2008. What would be the potential cost of you know, calling for impeachment? Would there be anything to be gained by the Democratic Party for doing that? And it's unclear that would be the case. We know that Republicans, even though President Clinton was impeached, Republicans did face a backlash in the 98 midterm elections, a small one, but they were hurt somewhat by it. So I don't see impeachment as being impending. I mean, he's almost out of office anyway, and you know, so far what we've seen is that the administration is unwilling to, you know, respond to inquiries, subpoena inquiries and so on from Congress. You know, would an impeachment hearing be any different?
Right.
And I don't know if it really would be.
Well, thank you so much for the hour, Professor Eshbaugh Soha. I really enjoyed it. Thanks.
Well, I did too. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. Professor Matthew Eshbaugh Soha, he's in the Department of Political Science at the University of North Texas, where he is assistant professor, and he's author of The President's Speeches Going Beyond Public. Thanks to Sharome Owens for producing this hour, and thanks also to Sharome for being our on-air producer for our All Things Political segment this Monday morning, the 16th of July. I'm Kathleen Dunn. News coming up from National Public Radio, and we'll return with more Monday conversation here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.